Welcome to Dice in Mind, a podcast hosted by Brad Brown and Jason Kaufman to explore the intersection of life, games, science, music, philosophy, and creativity through interviews with leading creatives. All are welcome in this space.
We'll keep our intro and everything short because you all know the folks. We've had each of these gentlemen on individually. Jim Johnson of Modiphius, Al Spader, who writes for Modiphius. And we won't get too deep into the work Al has led on the next book, because I think you will, it's better heard from the sources. Mm-hmm. But I will say that this is going to broaden the game in a really cool way.
We'll just lead with this. We are going to talk in a moment with Al and Jim about the Star Trek Adventures campaign guide, the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign. Al Spader is a middle school science teacher, father of five-year-old twin boys, and a freelance RPG writer and game designer. As a regular writer for Star Trek Adventures and lead designer of the Sentience 2D20 RPG, Al brings his knowledge of neurodivergence and social-emotional learning to the TTRPG community. Jim Johnson was born about the same time Apollo 12 landed on the moon and has always been kind of spacey, and shares a birthday with the Kindle. He is the author of the Pistols and Pyramids Weird Western series and the Potomac Shadows Urban Fantasy series. He's also written a bunch of other stuff in and around science fiction and fantasy genres and pen and paper RPGs. He's currently the project manager and line editor for Modiphius' Star Trek Adventures RPG.
So, Jim, Al, thanks for joining us.
Two for one deal.
Yeah, this is... Man, I'm without words because this is going to be awesome. We're going to end up splitting this episode just because we're going to have a lot to talk about.
I've already told my wife, let me rephrase that. My wife said to me earlier today when I saw, I was in meetings the entire day. In the little bit that I was home, she's like, so I'm not going to see you tonight? And I'm like, no.
Whereas yours is mine is like, really, you're going to be downstairs all night?
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
That, I am actually drinking iced coffee.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
So I can have some sort of functional brain for this just because I'm naturally tired. So you two have been involved in working on some of the latest material for Star Trek Adventures. You just announced most recently a new book. It's going to be coming out within the next, based off of when we record this, probably within the next month or so, I'm assuming. If you don't mind, to start this off, why don't you talk about what the material is? I'm kind of leaving this open for you. And then what precipitated the development of it?
It's so unique.
Yeah.
Al, why don't you take the first question about what it is, and then I'll talk a little bit about what precipitated it.
Right.
So we are talking about the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign, which is a campaign that tells a parallel story to the USS Discovery during the Federation Klingon War. As you know, campaigns are typically a bunch of stories that link together. But this book takes it to another level, where it includes this tactical overlay where players get to experience the roles of admirals who are assigning assets to deal with the war as a whole. And so you're basically bouncing between the role-playing sessions and then the strategic sessions, going back and forth and telling this really galactic story.
Yeah, and as far as what precipitated it, I have to think back. I have such a short-term memory for stuff. Like once I finish a book, I purge it, and then I move on to the next thing. We talked about this before. I think myself and the people at Modiphius in charge of helping me figure out, like, what's our product schedule going to look like? What kind of things do we want to do? One of them came up with the, or you know, collectively we came up with the idea of like, why don't we do like a tactical campaign, kind of harkening back to the FASA Starship Battle
Okay.
Simulator kind of thing, because that's something we haven't really done for Star Trek Adventures yet. Can we do something starshipy, something like that? And you know, I'll spill the tea here and say that at the very, very, very beginning stages, like way back when we were just kind of like initially concepting it, we actually thought it might be a box set. We thought it would be like a box set with tokens and cards and maps and stuff all inside it, right? And this was during the height of the pandemic, so a lot of things were still in flux, and you know, publishing costs have only gone up. The distribution was chaotic during the pandemic. If you, I mean, the height of the pandemic, I mean, we're still in the pandemic, but during the height of the pandemic, you remember ports were closing because, like, you get a port in China, that wave of COVID goes through it, they shut down completely for a month or 2 months or whatever. And like, so somewhere in that developmental process, early on, we were like, well, you know, if we did this, it would have to come from China because they're the ones who can do box sets most, you know, efficiently, cost-wise, time-wise, and you know, distribution-wise. But we knew with the pandemic and all these issues that were happening with the pandemic, it was going to be next to impossible to get anything out of China anytime soon, right? Because of all the delays and the shipping and stuff and whatnot. And we were like, okay, let's maybe rethink this and maybe go toward a book. And because we knew books come out of Europe, and getting a book from Europe to UK is far, far easier than getting a ship from China to anywhere at the time anyway. It's much improved now, obviously, but at the time it was like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be just crazy to make it happen. So anyway, we eventually settled on a book. And then at the time, Ivan Sorensen was working with Chris Birch on some stuff, and there was just an opportunity there for Ivan to say, oh, you know, I could pitch this like tactical campaign component and maybe work with the guys on figuring out how do we make it Star Trek-y, and then they could take it and go and run off with it. And that's pretty much what we did. Of course, at the time I was developing Captain's Log, Lower Decks, and I think we were wrapping up Utopia Planitia. So I had like four major books on my plate
It's
all at the same
ridiculous.
time.
My God.
And I think one night I was, you know, probably after an interview with somebody, I sat down and I looked at my workload and I was like, I can't do this alone. There's just no way. I just don't have that kind of time. And I was still working a day job at the time. And I was like, how am I going to get all this done on the schedules that they want me to get it done? And so that's why I reached out to Michael Dismuth to help me with Captain's Log. And that's why I reached out to Al to help me with the Klingon War book, because I knew, having worked with them for a couple year, year and a half, couple years prior to that, that they had, like, not only are they good writers, but they also had the, like, whatever mojo I thought they needed to effectively be lead writing on these individual projects. And so, you know, I took the chance, and fortunately, you know, it's always in hindsight you feel good that you were right? I hit a home run on Captain's Log, and I hit a home run on the tactical campaign books. So I felt pretty good about that, you know. And then I was able to focus on Lower Decks and Utopia Planitia and get those over the plate as well. So that all worked out. But yeah, so that was the kind of the genesis of Klingon War, is that we wanted to do a book that was like, oh, let's give players the chance to play admirals, you know, moving assets and ships and characters around on a board, collecting assets, attempting missions, accomplishing missions, but then also being able to either benefit or suffer from how those missions play out, and have that impact their role playing sessions when they play through the adventures and the mission briefs or whatever else that we put into the book. So that was kind of the genesis. Al, did I miss anything key in there?
No, I think you
That was
got
pretty.
it. The very first thing I saw was Ivan Sorensen's tactical overlay, and that kind of got me in the mindset. And being someone that loves to do crunchiness and mechanics, I was all about it. I was like, yeah, let's do this.
Could I ask, just for those that don't listen, what is Ivan's role involved in all this? Some folks may not necessarily know who Ivan Sorensen is, and I just.
Yeah, Ivan has written a series of games. One's called 5 Parsecs from Home. There's another one, five,
Five Leagues from the Borderlands.
yeah, five Borderlands, and a few other things. And in the ensuing years since we started this, I think he ended up, and I don't know the details, so Ivan, apologies if I get this wrong, but I think he sold those games to Modiphius. So now Modiphius actually owns those games outright and is going to continue to develop them and do other things with them. But I think Ivan was the genesis of those. And so he came up with the initial, like, first draft of the tactical campaign component, where we've got, you know, ships and assets and things going on, and then they go off and do missions. And then Al and the writing team that we put together took that and play tested it and refined it and refined it and refined it. And then we added in all the role-playing elements with the different adventures and mission briefs. So Ivan definitely is one of the, like, he helped create the foundation of it that we then built on. So we wanted to absolutely make sure that he got some credit in there, because he was a big piece of it.
5 parsecs and borderlands. I have those. They are phenomenal games. Yeah. So having him involved, you know, with you all on that, that's definitely a big plus.
Yeah. And those are procedurally generated games, right? That where you roll on tables to find out what the encounter is going to be, what the mission is going to be, what you need to do to be successful. You're rolling on charts and whatnot. And that those are meant to be miniatures games. So it was a good transition for him to just do, you know, a procedurally generated campaign engine for this tactical overlay.
So I found it interesting. And there's so many places we want to go, but I found it interesting, Al. So, like, we knew for a little bit that you were working on something like, or air quotes, something like no NDA here. I mean, we whatever that meant for whomever, we knew you had a project in process. That was it. And then when we saw that you had led the ship, so to speak, on a tactical campaign guide, I got a really real kick out of it. I said something to Brad, I think, because I didn't think, well, neither of us at all expected something like this guide. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
But, like, you had been on the show not that long ago. And it's like, such a nice guy. I mean, Al's just this sweet guy. And then his name is on this war guide. And I'm like, wow, respect. I did not see that coming. I get the writing part, but I didn't think, like, the war tactical campaign was going to be your thing, which is just very intriguing to me.
Yeah, I play a lot of tabletop war games. Like, I do Warhammer, I do, you know, Star Wars Legion, Star Wars Armada,
all sorts of games like that.
That's one of my fun things that I do. So this kind of, like, floated right into that. And, you know, and to be clear, like, you know, this tactical campaign is here. There's lots of stuff about war, but we also tried to really ground it in the first half of the book, talking about stories that you can tell. And I think that's really where this guide is applicable across all Star Trek.
It's such good reading. I mean, we'll talk about the mechanics too, hopefully, but like, ever since Jim got us on this kick 2 years ago, I mean, in terms of RPG is lit, like, I keep going through it just because of the narrative instructions and how, yeah, the whole asset thing is really interesting, and how that builds story that you play in. Okay, so I want to ask a question. This is maybe more for you, Jim. This is my assumption as being, like, a user, a player, whatever. But looking through the guide at the layout, it seems like beautifully iterative of some of the things you learned in what you all did with Captain's Log. Like, to me, there are very intent, like taking some of the best pieces from that, and we know you're always iterating. You've said that to us, but that it looked like it just had that very lovely touch. Like, it's got a bit of a different look, a bit of a different feel. Not the narrative, but the actual physical book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, of course, hindsight always being 2020, I don't think I saw this necessarily when we were in the throes of developing Captain's Log and the tactical campaign book at the same time.
Okay.
I think because I'm the lead editor, line editor, and also the project, mostly because I'm wearing the line editor hat right now. Right. I was looking at both these books at the same time. And even Lower Decks, I think Lower Decks has some a lot more random tables in it than we normally put into our books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Lower Decks random tables informed the random tables that are in Utopia Planitia, right? So I think Utopia, Lower Decks, Captain's Log, and then this book, the technical war, there's a thread going through all four of them, right? Where we were picking up the pieces and just, like, taking the good ideas from them and sharing them back and forth. I think part of it's because I was looking at all four of these books at pretty much the same time in different stages, right? I think we were laying out Utopia when we were developing Lower Decks and Captain's Log, and then this one came on right on top of it, right? Because they were all in development for a long time. I just slightly different. I mean, if you look at the what is it? Brad, help me here. Is it a Gantt chart? Is that the?
Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Gantt. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, you're actually, you know, planning out with prereqs and
right, and you're stacking up the different projects and the timelines and like who's committed when, and you see the overlaps and stuff. So these four books overlapped each other quite a bit.
That's amazing.
And I think especially Captain's Log and Tactical Campaign. In retrospect, I look at these two books and I'm like, ah, shoot, you could play the Tactical Campaign for a couple phases. And then use all that information to go right into a Captain's Log story.
Yeah.
And then take all that absolutely. Stuff that happens in the Captain's Log, go right back into the Tactical Campaign, do your next turn or your next phase or whatever. And then just make that nice little ecosystem happen where, you know, if you're a player who's frustrated and you can't find a group to play with, either online or in person, get yourself a copy of Captain's Log, get yourself a copy of the Tactical Campaign. You're done.
Oh
you got gaming material for years, right? You're set.
See that? You know? We always talk about points of entry, and just I mean, Captain's Log's a point of entry, but when you do that, you've even created a more robust ecosystem to play in. And to me, even with me, I just during the past couple of weeks reread Captain's Log as a novel, just reading through it and everything. At this moment, when you just mentioned using the tactical manual and then adding Captain's Log together,
I never knew how much I wanted random tables in STA until Captain's Log, because that really wasn't a thing in the games that I was playing before that I played over the years, and. I mean, obviously, Captain, we've talked about this, and we talked about this with Michael, the random tables work so well. And then Al in the tactical guide, the campaign tactical guide or tactical campaign guide. It's amazing to me that you were working on these concurrently, because it does feel like such an iteration to me. Like I was flipping through or scrolling through and you've got these tables. And it's like, that's exactly where they need to be. Yeah. Like, they're not at the end. They're not a section. It's like, you're going, boom. Now you have to use these tables and you're back to narrative. And I really think it's just it's an elegant flow of how you do that random number generation in the narrative and kind of dance in and out. And you know what I mean? Like, it's not pulling you out. Mm-hmm. It's driving you deeper. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've seen that anywhere.
Yeah, and I think Al, you need to talk on that a little bit, because I think it was you and your team who really kind of came up with that workflow. I mean, I know we worked on the outline together, but again, because I was working on those other three books, I don't think I really had the opportunity to really get my head completely wrapped around what I wanted the Tactical Campaign book to be. And I think that's where Al, as lead writer, really, really jumped in and took it over.
It was a challenge, right? Because if you look at the Game Master section, which is chapter 2 of the book, we start introducing what the tactical campaign is before people even know what different terminology is, right? I'm kind of front loading the information. I mean, Jason, you're a teacher, you know that you front load the information, you front load the vocabulary, and then you drill deeper with it, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of the setup here that we went for. So we talk about points of interest. We talk about, you know, everything that is the tactical campaign, but we don't come right out and say what it is in chapter 2. Then when you get to chapter 3, that's when you drill down to the tactical overlay rules. And that's where you find out what is a point of interest, what is an asset, what is a resource, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
So I think that was intentional. And so like when you get to the rules, you're like, oh, I've heard these words before. Like, this makes sense to me now. And then what we did that is, I think, fairly unique through chapters 4, 5, and 6 it's a very linear story, because you are telling this parallel story to where what the USS Discovery does in season 1, right? So we divided the campaign into 3 stages: early war, mid war, and late war. So in the storytelling part of this, we have scripted events which actually happen in the show to kind of keep track of where you are in the timeline. Then you have an adventure that bookends each stage, And then the middle of the stage, that's where you're playing the tactical overlay. That's where you're assigning your assets. That's where you can be pulling in the mission briefs. So it's actually very linear as you read through chapters 4, 5, and 6, which is kind of cool.
It is very quick. It flows. It's okay. So but I just one my other burning question here, and then I'll stop, and it's all you, Brad. But why the Klingon Federation War? I mean, granted, you had choices, but I'm curious, like, why that?
Jim, you want me to give my answer, or do you want to give your answer first?
No, you go ahead and give your answer first.
So the reason why I was so excited about it, Jason, is because the USS Discovery is gone for 75% of the war.
Right.
This war happens while the Discovery is off over in the Mirror Universe. So it's really this, we know this war happens. We know it got really, really bad for the Federation.
Right.
But now you have an opportunity to tell a story as a hero ship. And that's what I got excited about.
Yeah, fair. And Jim's answer is they wouldn't let him do the Romulan War.
No,
the Dominion War.
I'll be honest. I pulled up Wiki just to make sure I was getting the dates right. So we started concepting this and developing this in, it had to be 21.
Yeah.
And season 3 of Discovery had just ended. They were getting ready to start season 4.
Okay.
And I think at the time, Discovery was, I mean, you had Discovery, Picard, and I think the first couple seasons of Lower Decks, Discovery was still pretty hot, right? I mean, it had its naysayers, of course, but it was still pretty much the big Star Trek show that was on the air. And we really liked it, and I liked it. And it was a lot of what Al was saying is that there's a huge chunk of the war where there's just like, you don't know what happens. They kind of allude to it. And then, but then the Discovery comes back and then they resolve the season. But like from the storytelling potential, it's like, ooh, as a game master and a group of players, there's a huge swath of time in canon where like the Federation's on its heels. What kind of stories can you tell? What kind of stories could a game group tell in that period of time? Okay. So that was a big piece of it. So I mean, those are the two big pieces of it, right? Okay. Discovery was really big at the time, and we wanted to certainly take advantage of that from a purely, you know, marketing / capitalistic point of view. You want to go with the hot thing, just because it'll help everything. And plus, I think that was one of the first times we really kind of realized the big Star Trek meta of that there was a whole new generation of Star Trek fans coming into the franchise via Discovery, right? Yep. I mean, not Picard, not Lower Decks. Yep. Of course, Lower Decks brought them along eventually, but Discovery was the new thing. And there was a whole new generation of kids and people getting into Star Trek because of Discovery. And that's certainly, you know, an audience that we wanted to tap into with the role-playing game, because it was just an opportunity, especially because a lot of them had never played an RPG before, or were maybe looking to it for an alternative from, you know, Pathfinder, D&D, Vampire, whatever. They wanted to try something different. And, you know, I remember distinctly seeing a lot of conversation online about people who heard about Star Trek Adventures and were like, oh, I didn't know there was a Star Trek D&D. Right, because D&D has kind of become synonymous with RPGs now, right? So they were like, oh, it's a Star Trek D&D? It's like, it's a Star Trek D&D, sure. So there's a lot of reasons built into it, but I think those are the two big ones.
I mean,
and then, of course, it was an opportunity to do something different with the line, right? Because we hadn't really done in the Command Source book, we kind of played with the idea that, yeah, you could do an Admiralty-level campaign where you're commanding sectors instead of a single ship. But this was the first opportunity for us to really blow that out into an actual game or a mini game component and say, okay, now you can actually be admirals making hard decisions and sending off ships and assets and stuff and trying to resolve missions and having that tension point of like, I have more missions to attempt than I have assets. What do I do? Or I have three really hard missions to focus on. Which ones do I focus on and which ones do I let go? And Al is so cool because, like, I know that Michael and I, we played the game a couple of weeks ago on Continuing Conversations. We played through the first couple turns. And, like, our very first turn, we had, a really hard tactical mission related to a starbase, right? Like, the Klingons were attacking a starbase. And we had, like, four other missions that were almost equally as important. And we started assigning assets, and the mission with the starbase, we just didn't have any assets left to assign to it. Wow. So the Klingons blew up a starbase in the first phase of the war.
The
and
guilt.
We're like, oh,
the
shoot.
Guilt.
What kind of storytelling potential does it have, though, right? Because that if we were then to go into Captain's Log, we'd be like, okay, this episode opens up. Starbase 6 has just been blown to smithereens by the Klingons because the Federation got completely, gobsmacked by this war starting, completely unprepared.
Yeah.
The Klingons draw first blood and blow up this starbase, which, probably has, 10,000 people on it, right? More, maybe. This starbase is a significant, asset, right? And it's like, oh gosh. And that really kind of informed our whole episode because, like, oh, we just lost that starbase. What do we do now? Oh my God. So it's just, it was a great opportunity to add something different to the line. And, ultimately, again, looking back, 2020 hindsight, it was another gigantic tool, a bunch of tools that we could throw at players and game masters and say, okay, you haven't gotten enough tools yet. Here's some more tools to go do what you want with your Star Trek campaign, whatever direction you do it in, whatever species you're playing as, whatever civilizations you want, just here's even more tools to play with. And I think fans right now are just starting, like the hardcore fans that we're targeting are just starting to get a sense of the potential of this book and this campaign. And I think this is going to help too. I mean, just talking about the fact that you can combine the tactical campaign with Captain's Log by itself should open up some eyes, I think.
Well, and hopefully the timing too, which I don't know, maybe this is coincidence, maybe it's not, but as this two-parter drops, mm-hmm. right, the episodes, not the book, but the final season of Discovery is just a few more weeks out. I mean, that's really good timing, all things considered. I mean, it looks mm-hmm. that season looks like it could honestly be great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to bring attention back to Discovery. And I mean, you guys have the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Al and I and Michael talk about this a lot on chat. It's like, it's so weird. And I mean, if you think about karma or the great koala in the sky or the collective unconscious or whatever, it's really weird how timing has worked out on a lot of our books, right? Yeah, like Utopia Planitia, we got that done and it came out right about the time Picard season 3 came out, and Star Trek Online managed to get a bunch of their ships canonized. Yeah. And we happened to have some of those ships in Utopia Planitia.
Yep. Yeah, so cool.
Because Thomas didn't tell us. And it was just this nice little synergy of like, oh, this book came out at just the right time because we've got ships in there that are now canon, and it just worked out. Like Lower Decks had some charming moments of timing. And then this book had a very long adventure in 2023 getting out. Like, we had intended this to be a fall 23 publication.
Wow. Okay.
But just, stuff happened in 2023 that mm-hmm. caused it to be delayed and delayed and delayed. And finally, it came out now, right? And you're right. We had no idea when Discovery Season 5 was going to come out. Because we knew the pandemic slowed it down. And then we knew it was, I think in the fall, we knew it was coming, but we didn't know when.
Yep.
And then it wasn't until, I don't think it was until the Super Bowl when they actually announced it's coming out in April.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And I know Al and I talked about it. We're like, oh, shoot, that last season's coming out like right after our book comes out. This is perfect timing. Yep. How did that happen? Right? Yeah. It's just, we got lucky, I guess. Whoever's looking out for Star Trek Adventures, I got to thank them for it because we've just gotten lucky with the timing a number of times here.
Yeah, and we talked about it too, Jim. That this book was almost completely done by the time Strange New Worlds had started airing.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
So we really lucked out in like the Mbenga Chapel story arc in season mm-hmm. two, where they're telling stories about the Federation Klingon War, right? And we introduced the trauma system.
That's very interesting. Book.
And here we are seeing Mbenga like playing it on the screen, and I'm like, this is our book right here. So mm-hmm. we very serendipitous.
Yeah, because I mean, we were by the time, especially season two, I think season two especially of Strange New Worlds, there was a lot of episodes that involved Mbenga and Chapel.
Yeah.
Like either reflecting back on their wartime experiences or actually literally showing us flashbacks.
Like the MASH episode.
Yeah, the MASH episode. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I know we were both watching that episode And it's like, oh yeah, I was pumping, I was doing the fist pump. Like, yeah. This is exactly what's, because we were in the middle of layout of the book at the time, because, you know, it was already pretty much locked down. And I was like, oh man, all that trauma stuff that Michael Duxbury wrote, that chapter on scars and the trauma of war, and how
really interesting.
How wartime situations change your character fundamentally. I mean, nobody gets out of a war unscathed, right? And it's like, so it was one thing, like a year prior to that, when we were doing the manuscript and I was editing the manuscript, I was like, yeah, this is really cool. And I was identifying more with Nog, right? Because in the yeah. Dominion War, I think he is the one character in the Dominion War that really best exemplified how a war can change you and impact you, you know, because he lost his leg. But then once we got to layout, then season two came out, and I saw that episode. Well, there was two episodes, right? There was the episode with M'Banga dealing with the Klingon ambassador dude, and then maybe possibly killing him at the end.
Definitely killing him at
hard
the
to
end.
Say.
Not hard to say.
And then the MASH episode with Chapel and M'Banga.
That's so
and I was like,
good.
Oh, this is perfect. Like it, when we, I knew, like, the instant I watched that episode, I was like, oh, as soon as we start doing interviews and continuing conversations, we got to mention these episodes, because that's going to help players and game masters have an immediate reference point. We'll say, go read that chapter on scars and the traumas of war, and then go watch those episodes, because that's exactly what you can do with your characters and your players in the game, if you want to, right? I think this was the first book, Al, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the first book where we had a content warning up front, saying, you know, this book is going to cover some hard stuff. And we really, I mean, I think we did it in the player's guide a little bit, but in this book, we really tried to push the button hard about have that session zero with your players and your game master, and really truly talk about this stuff and make sure that everybody's on board with wanting to go into a wartime kind of storyline. That's right, isn't it? Wasn't it the player's guide, and then we expanded on it in this one?
Right, and we even included a consent form in the back. Yeah. And those will be, the consent form will be available as individual PDFs to download as well.
Just to clarify, Brad, no still means no. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm excited. Like it's like, so you can rate it full speed ahead. You can rate it yellow alert, which means it's okay to happen.
Yeah.
Off screen.
So clever.
And then red alert. No, I don't want this in my game at all. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to deal with it. So really, really cool to hand out during a session zero.
It's interesting because, and certainly some tables, you know, they're not going to want to go obviously in that direction, or to that extent, they're going to want to, you know, they're going to want to play like, well, no, we're kind of still a more like superheroes, right? Like we don't level up, but we want to level up. Like we want to be the big bads in this quadrant and do our thing. And that obviously that's fine. But I think it's interesting to me because it almost to me honors Trek. Like we've talked about, Jim, and of course many have said this, but that Trek isn't science fiction, it's a history of the future. And if you roll, pun intended, but if you roll that way, then if you're going to really have a combat-based game, then maybe you want to really seriously consider what are the ramifications short and long term for your PCs. And you've given us that guide to do that, which I think has got to be pretty darn novel in RPG land. I don't know that I've seen anything like that. I mean, maybe some trigger warnings or whatever, which the research actually says do more harm than good, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Do you need, because you kind of mentioned with the little pips and tokens and things like that, do you need to play this as a miniatures game? Or can it function without it? Just because a lot of folks are going to probably, you know, look at it and go, oh, this would probably be good with miniatures. And I know Modiphius has some out there. But you could play it either way, correct?
I think so. We've included tracking sheets for both points of interest and assets, so that you can keep a full log of who you have to deploy where. You don't have to have anything. You can just use those to keep track of your stuff. That said, we do on the front inside cover, we have included that awesome Federation Klingon War map from season one. And you can like put like glass beads down to say, okay, this is where point of interest one is, and like things like that, clever, if you want to keep track that way. But it's designed to not have to do all those things. You absolutely can. Like Michael Dismuke wants to set up a big, map and push pawns away with a little
Oh, that's
baton or
cool.
whatever. And you can absolutely do that if you want, but you don't need to.
That you, if you're going to do that, you got to have that on Continuing Conversations, and you need one of those cameras that comes down.
So that's overhead.
I want to hear Michael say, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." That would really, really make my day.
So I'll add that. So you certainly don't need miniatures because it's not really it's not a miniatures campaign, like in the sense of like D&D, where you're doing 5 foot steps and you're actually figuring out positioning and stuff, right? But it's like what Al was saying is like on a general broad scope. Oh, there's a mission on planet X. We're going to send this ship to that planet. We're going to send this character to that planet. You could push them around that way. That's certainly fine. But what Michael and I discovered when we were doing it on Continuing Conversations is that Al actually on his own, for the love, actually created a bunch of cards, asset cards that have the ship and the characters on the card, and
Very
they're in
cool.
the style of the old Decipher Star Trek collectible card game.
Wait.
So he found the same format, and so Michael and I found those really invaluable because it was easier to visualize what ships and what assets we had. And then we kind of like moved them around on the screen as we were assigning them to different missions. They're not necessary, obviously. They're just a tool that are nice to have. And of course, Al was gracious enough to make those and then provide them for free on continuing missions. So if you
I was
wanted to
gonna say
download them,
you blogged those, right? I'm like that we saw those, didn't we? Those look good.
yeah.
Yeah,
And somebody
I did
else,
a few, and then somebody else posted some more
yeah,
abstract ones on Reddit recently
on
as
Reddit,
well.
yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I don't remember the username, but if you go to the subreddit for Star Trek Adventures. Somebody posted some really fantastic, like blank generic cards that you could use for
Nice.
any war,
Okay.
right? Like where Al's are a little bit more specific to what we had in the Klingon War book, which is fine. He created generic ones, which works just as well too. So I found the cards useful, and in fact, I even remember Al telling me in the middle of the development of the book that we really should do a card deck. And again, at the time, it just wasn't really feasible to do a card deck. I knew it was going to be a really hard sell to the people at Modiphius to say, "Hey, we're doing this book. I think we should do a card deck with it," right? So that was a tricky call, but now, of course, in retrospect, it's like, shoot, we should have done a card deck, or we should have found a way to put like perforated pages in the book with punch out cards or something. But I mean, even with that, there was what 60. There's 20 character assets, there's 20 ship assets, and there's 20 resource assets. So that would have been 60 cards. That would have been hard to put into a book.
I'm glad you didn't do that. As neat as that would be, I hate having to tear things out.
I knew you were going
Yeah.
to say that.
Because you're the same. I hate having to tear things out of such a beautiful book. Like, I would much rather just pay for something
For a
in
deck.
addition. Though I think a sign of any good system is like it's extensible. And you guys, you especially, Jim, you've always been good about supporting supporting the players, right? And the community. And so the fact that already you have people generating these tools on top, that says something about the durability already of the system.
Well, and I actually, because I do some, I've mentioned this in the past, some sports gaming with cards. And I found through talking with someone, I have perforated laser paper
Oh,
that's
cool.
three, it's six cards per page, three and three, or it's eight cards per page, four and four.
Nice.
And I could just see myself now, just actually like cutting out, screenshotting the card and laying it out on this so that I can print it out and perforate them and then send
Walk
a
around
cut.
the house whispering, my precious.
You're just on a roll today, aren't
I
you?
am, but it's good to have you back home where I can pick on you more freely.
I'll just interject here and say you're a jackass and let's move on.
Well,
So you have,
nothing new
and
there.
yeah, I know. Way back when, air quotes, there is a Discovery campaign guide 2256 to 2258. And I'm looking at it, or I'm figuratively looking at it over on my shelf. Do you see that playing in at all? I'm curious so that
Yeah, how
people
do those
understand that
intersect?
is that one is A and one is B, and the Venn diagram is not necessarily them intersecting.
No, I think they're, Al, I want to hear your perspective on this too. I think they're definitely related. I think the two books serve different purposes. I think the campaign guide 56 to 58, that was really aren't being intentional about trying to cover those 2 years, but also, you know, creating a bridge from Enterprise to the original series, right? The fairly lengthy descriptions we have in there about what, like, what was happening before Discovery season one, how does that relate to Discovery season one, how does that carry through to Discovery season two, and then how does things go from the end of Discovery season two to the original series, right? Because like canon can't put those dots together like we can,
right,
in the RPG, and that Discovery campaign guide came out even before Strange New Worlds did, so we didn't know that there was going to be a Strange New Worlds,
right,
you know, chunk of time in between Discovery and the original series, although it all hangs together pretty well, I think, you know, canonically. And then we added some information about Section 31, of course, because Section 31 was a big deal in season two. Mm-hmm. We added a little bit about the Terran Empire, which we hadn't really touched on yet in the game line. So it was an opportunity to do a lot of different things with that Discovery campaign guide that we hadn't done before and use it as kind of a, I mean, really, it was another tool set. And I think the Discovery Campaign Guide was also one of our first books that really gave us an opportunity to focus on the independent campaign, right? Like, if you want to play Independence, you know, use the player guide, tie that in with the Discovery Campaign Guide, and go be Harry Mudd, or go be, right, you know, Ferengi merchants, or go be some Nausicaan marauders or something.
Nice.
So, and then the war happens, right? And then how does that change your stories? Like, you're all of a sudden you're looking to make some latinum on the side, and then the war breaks out. Now what do you do? So I think there's a lot of stuff going on in that Discovery campaign guide that I think would be beneficial to people who aren't even fans of Discovery, right? Because we added so much stuff that covers the gamut from Enterprise to the original series. And then, you know, the tactical campaign guide, that's specifically about the war. It's specifically about wartime. It's specifically about what do characters who join a science organization do when they're suddenly thrust into a war.
That was, right, fascinating.
You didn't sign up for that.
Love that.
Like, you know, you go join NOAA and all of a sudden you're doing, you know,
you're in the Navy,
border defense with the Navy. Exactly. Right. Like, this isn't what you expected.
So I think, you know, the whole RPG is lit thing. I think the Discovery guide, that, you know, the 2256-58, that's a great read as well. Yeah. Oh. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the tactical campaign is going to do the same thing. Question about, because I don't think.
Wait, I want to pause because I want Al to get in here because you didn't give your pitch.
Oh, yeah, please.
Sorry.
It's just a couple of things. So I had that Discovery guide on hand at all times when we were putting this together. So we definitely drilled down deeper into the events that happened during the war. We give a fully detailed timeline of the events that happened during the war. So that's one intersection. The other intersection is, if you want more content, if you have done all of your mission briefs and you want more mission briefs, I took all of the mission briefs out of the Discovery campaign guide that were applicable to the time period and adapted them so that they can be used for the war. So
cool.
Basically every mission and mission brief in the tactical campaign have a success criteria and a failure criteria. And if you succeed, you get bonuses in the tactical overlay when you're playing your admirals. If you fail, you get some negatives when you do that. So I took out actually a couple of missions and the mission briefs from the Discovery campaign guide and added those success and failure criteria. And they're in the GM chapter as additional content if you want more to run the game.
Yeah. And Al, I don't remember if I actually told you or not, but I thank you for doing that. I remember reading the manuscript, and I had to read it a couple times to understand what I was looking at. And I was like, oh shit, he went back to the Discovery campaign guide and he pulled all that content in and made it relevant to this one. And it was just, it just adds more value to both books because now you got a nice little cross reference between the two. And again, it's another tool that players can and game masters can now use and say, well, you know, I've got the Discovery campaign guide. I wish I could get more utility out of it. Oh, wait a minute. Look, this new book just came out and it's got content from that book in this book. And now I can use even more mission briefs and even more missions. And
that's good project management and marketing, right? Of, wow, you know, that book you already purchased would be even more useful if you purchased the next one.
Right.
That's what I, when I looked through it, I saw, I'm like, this is a great, almost companion to it. And to hear Al, you talking about how you did that, the Venn diagram actually does have some crossover to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you, in this situation, I don't think, Jim, I've ever, maybe we've asked this. I think we may have talked about it just in, you know, tertiary to others. How do you play test something like this? For the both of you, Al's laughing. How do you play test and iterate something like this? And I would assume that it probably is parallel to some of the other play test stuff you've done with other books too.
Al, you want to talk about the play testing for this one a little bit?
Yeah, and please, I hope I'm not stepping out and asking things.
No, I think this is a good question. And so Jim said, hey, this is yours now. Figure out how to make this work with Star Trek. You can play test it. So I brought in I think I told you guys that I like to play tactical combat games. And I brought in one of my closest friends who I've done that with forever. And he and I sat every weekend for 2 months playing through this. And recording what happened each turn, et cetera, et cetera. And the first 2 weeks we saw that like it was not really balanced the way that we wanted it to be. So we came up with a concept which we called primary power, which is your characters and your ships are designed to do specific things. So if they happen to be assigned to a mission that is dealing with those specific things, they get to reroll 1d20 when they attempt their task. So that right there smoothed out the dice rolls and made it a lot less swingy. And so like every time that we made a little tweak like that, I would send Ivan a list of, hey, here's three things that we noticed. Here's three things that I think could fix it. And every single time Ivan was like, that sounds awesome. Go nuts. And he was spectacular to work with because like he would respond to me within 2 hours, almost every time that I emailed him.
Wow.
So we went back and forth on that several times. You know, like I said, for almost 2 months we were play testing, at the same time I was writing stuff for the book as well. But that was a really, really cool experience.
Did that influence your writing?
I think when it came down to it, yes. Like when I was actually being creative and whatnot, yeah. I had a really good idea of what I wanted to get into the book. And a lot of the story stuff was done by the team. I got to do the research and the mechanical type stuff. So there's a lot of optional rules in this book. And Jim said, hey, go through all the other 2D20 lines, core rule books, see if there's anything that can apply to war and adapt to Star Trek. Go through the system reference document, see if there's anything that can be adapted to Star Trek. And so like that was a majority of my time was spent researching all these other lines and trying to adapt stuff into the Star Trek game.
In that vein, actually, you kind of brought us to a question I have. So obviously you've done your own stuff beyond STA, but this was your first lead as a project, right?
Yes.
So I'm curious, and like we've asked Jim this too, and we asked Michael, but I'm curious, were there parts that like you most enjoyed, whether it was the writing or the research or the working? Like you have a heck of a lineup of writers on this book. Were there things that you just, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of it was great, hopefully, but where were those bursts of joy for you as a lead writer on this?
So for me, it was when, you know, three or four of us writers got together and started saying, well, what should we be doing here? Like, what stories are we going to tell? How can we make sure that we're covering all the events as they flow through the timeline? I love like shooting, like sitting around and just talking with people about games. And so that was just so much fun. And once you see everybody on the same page and then the content starts coming in and you're like, wow, everybody really is same page. That right there to me was like, this is how gaming should be done. I think I've been learning a lot that there's a lot of, I don't want to say selfishness, but a lot of game designers like hold their designs very close to their heart. And that goes for content and systems as well. And so like sometimes they don't want to work in teams, but for me, just my experience with STA, I think you get the best product possible when you have a team. And seeing and bringing that team together and organizing them, I think that was the most fun of the entire project.
Yeah, it's Star Trek, man. we're stronger as a team, right? Isn't that what we learned from 1966 onward? We're better as a team. We're more effective as a team. Al, you make a great point. It blows me away, like especially in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, I see a lot of game books or a lot of game products from other companies, you know, all kinds of companies come out and there's like one name. There's like one name or maybe two names either on the cover or in the credits or something. And I'm like, really? One person did this entire thing, this 300-page core book or this, you know, 100-page starter set or whatever. Like literally one person did this. How is that possible? Like, I mean, is it just their one creative collective vision and they're just doing their thing? And it's like, I just don't get it. And then I look at our stuff and I'm like, a team built this. Like we're stronger. We cross-pollinate and we throw ideas at each other all the time. Especially, you know, a few books back, we were all collaborating on the outlines, and then I realized that was a bit much. But we would throw a lot of ideas back and forth on the outlines, and be like, oh, we could do this, we could do this, and but ultimately, it made the product stronger, right? Because it was a collective effort as opposed to one person saying, here's what we're gonna do, go do it, and having no creative energy. And it harkens back to my dark ages when I was involved in creating a comic book. And I wrote the scripts and I was like, wait, I want my philosophy was I'm writing the script. I want the artist to add their own creativity to it and make it better. Right? But then there was a different writer who was like, no, I'm going to write the script and I want the artist to draw that, like just draw what I wrote. And it's like, well, but they can't because they're creative, right? They're not just going to just draw what you want them to do because they've got to put their own spin on it and it might actually make it better. Right? And they couldn't see that, but, so like, it just blows my mind that there are games out there that have been like created by one person. It's like, but it should be a team.
A true story. I'm working on a role-playing game right now called Once Upon that, will hopefully be out quarter one this year. And the group that I'm working with, the Yellow Hand, I went into our team meeting and I said, all right, who wants to write something for this book? And everybody sat there like with their jaw down. Like I was asking, you know, they're like, wait. And like one of the guys, like, I'm just an artist. I'm like, I don't care. Do you want to create a kingdom into the book? You know what I mean? And I said, you know, I think that this product can be better if everybody gives a little insight to it. So we've got a couple of extra writers jumping in there and, you know, I'm a very big proponent of working as a team.
That's a theme, that's really Jim, cool. That from the first episode we had you on.
First time we ever talked to you.
You made that clear. And even when you and Michael were on or when we were each individually, you've always said, you know, this is always a team effort. And I think that is, it's culturally unique when it comes to a business environment. And it just shows the quality of the product. I have a question. I think probably this will be a good time to end for our...
Part one.
When we go to part two, I'm going to use a term that I just loathe, but it's the best description. I kind of want to talk about or just start the conversation about the sausage making and of the project management of this, just because this is a little different that I'm assuming than a regular book. So I just wanted to get your take as a PM nerd, Jim, if we could. So. Yeah, sure. Let's do that second time around and we'll continue this conversation, not to attack your trademark of continuing conversations, but we will
it on.
Continue the conversation on our next episode.
Awesome.
As we sit down and have our tea or coffee at Audubon Court, we're going to make this brief because this is just part one of our chat with Jim.
Our 14 part chat. No, not yeah. really. Not
no,
really.
But you know, I'm sitting down with my tea and my coffee and getting ready to listen to part two on our next episode. Mm-hmm. So books and everything have just kind of gone on hold just because of talking about the tactical campaign and everything else.
And to just speak about that for a moment, it is a beautiful book in terms of production, in terms of readability. Again, RPG is lit. This has been one that's really intrigued me. It's a different way of looking at the gaming system. It really expands upon it. And then just the layout is so readable. You know, and you know, Jim has said this, I think every time we've had him on the show and countless times offline, that every book he oversees for the Star Trek Adventures line, he seeks to iterate it forward. And I think this one is one where especially you see that there was at least some cross-pollination with everything going on. So we'll keep this short, but needless to say, I think this book in spirit, because of course it's a pre-order, but this book in spirit has been on our mental desks since we got wind of it.
But if you pre-order it,
you get the PDF.
You get the PDF.
And it is, and that's how we know, right? Yeah. And it is gorgeous. And Al, it's so fun to have him on to talk about this because it's his baby.
Yeah.
And to hear him go, so man.
And let's be honest, he's got one of the coolest offices ever.
Yeah, you know? It's when we have people like Al on where it's a shame we're only audio podcast. Because the geekery behind just the sheer volume of volumes.
Yes.
And miscellany. Truly impressive.
Yep.
All right. You know the deal, everybody. Not only come back for part two, please, with Al Spader and Jim Johnson, really good friends of the podcast. If you like what we're doing, if you enjoyed this episode, if you've enjoyed any of our episodes, if you have no idea why you're even listening to this episode, please, on your favorite podcast app, give us a rating, give us a 5-star rating. Help us spread the word. We are fortunate that after a few years, Dice in Mind is certainly beating the Midland of all the podcasts out there. But we'd really appreciate your help in spreading the word, spreading the gospel, if you will, of RPGs for just so many good reasons, and for sitting down and playing them, for talking about them, for reading them. So give us a rating, tell your friends, and in the interim, be well, stay well. We will see you in a couple of weeks.